Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
Hi, folks. Welcome along to Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman. I hope this finds you well. And I also hope that you have had the chance to get along to the cinema to see one of the many brilliant productions that are up there for you to see, whether they be big, whether they be small, whether they be independent, whether they be blockbuster, whatever floats your boat. There are some extraordinary films around and about for you guys to see. So yeah, also at home, I know that for some people, getting out to cinema might still be a thing for you post-COVID. I know for a lot of people that is. But wherever you feel safe and in a good place to watch film, whether that be in cinema, which I thoroughly encourage you to do just for that full experience. But there is so much great stuff to see. I wanted to shout out that The Outrun is also now available to watch at home. So you should definitely get your ears around that one as well. And also today's film that we're about to talk about. And yet another bonus episode. Ben, thank you. We are busy. We are bringing you a Soundtracking Everyman Film Club recorded live at Screen on the Green in Islington, North London. This time with director Ian Bonnot and composer Ilan Eshkri. They join me to discuss their collaboration on Ian and his co-director Peter Etadugi's beautiful documentary Superman, the Christopher Reeve story. It's one of those things where I felt like I grew up watching Superman, those Superman films, they were great. Christopher Reeve always associated with that character. I didn't know much about his early life as a stage actor, his kind of deep-rooted friendship and being a student with Robin Williams. And then also just the details about his accident and also the work that him and his wife and his family did and his family continued to do. So it's a really beautiful discovery of the man, Christopher Reeve, and who he was and what he did and achieved before his accident, but also after it. Ilan's score is just quite simply stunning, even as you hear garnering a round of applause from our audience at Screen on the Green. And we'll begin with his cue, Regaining Movement. Thank you so much for being here. That's actually the third time I've seen it. And it gets me every time. I know the story, but it gets me every time. Congratulations. You've made a really beautiful, beautiful film. Where did the journey start? Why did you want to tell Christopher and his family's story?
The journey started first with actually an archive producer who got in touch with the family. And he was looking for archive of Christopher Reeve at this time, and he just asked them if they would be open to make a film. And at that time, they were selling their home, the family home. It was time for them. It was in 2018, 19, I think, if I remember, or even later. And he reached out to Matt Reeve, and they decided to, it was a good time to do it. And together, they actually approached different production company and directors, and we got involved.
Why did you want to do it?
When we got the phone call, we didn't say yes on the phone call, but literally we put the phone down and it was like, yes. for us, it was really, it was a no-brainer. We hadn't made a film since talking to you, actually, in 2020, Rising Phoenix, which we've got lovely people in the audience that help us make Rising Phoenix at the time. And we had a little bit of a frustrating journey because it was COVID. He ended up on a streamer. Not many people watched it. And we loved that film. And we really put our heart and soul. It was about the Paralympic movement and people, you know, great athletes living with disabilities. And then we made another film, McQueen, which we talked to you about as well. And so we felt that a biopic of an artist and such a strong element of disability activism, and actually getting the chance to play with the Superman icon. And, you know, when do you get the chance to actually do the original story of Superman? At the time, Warner Brothers wasn't involved. So there was a lot of sweaty nights about trying to get the footage and the archive on that side, and you know, thinking, are they going to come after us? You know, we were talking to the archive people, and then I probably asked, you'll ask more questions, but yeah.
There are so many elements to it. You, I mean, you have that beautiful honesty from the kids, you know, which is a big ask of them, but they're so generous with their honesty and their telling of their stories. But there is so much there that you feel, we feel like we were there. And the way that you have him narrate a lot of the story as well, just really interested about how you came to the decision of the narrative of the film, you know, in terms of how it would start, the kind of beginning, middle and end, I guess, as well, if that was a journey in itself.
Yeah, completely. I mean, we straight away, because of Chris's tragic accident, we were worried if we had told the story chronologically, you would have a movie of two halves. The half of the healthy, though he was healthy, but you know what I mean, the actor, the success and the crash of his career in a way at the end of Superman. And then you would have someone, the 9 years of him rebuilding himself. We didn't want that. We loved the idea of actually playing between the juxtaposition. We came up very quickly with this idea of heroism and what it meant as a screen hero and as a Western and world icon, and as a true human being, which actually, by just wanting to move the needle of society, becomes a hero himself. So that was one of the themes, and the best way to do that was to juxtapose the two narratives. And Chris wrote two books, and we got access to the audio voice because he made them as audiobooks. Matt Reeve was very much involved in those two books. And the way he constructed one of the books was very much a double narrative again. But they were just chapters, but he didn't just do his journey as a disabled individual after the accident. He constantly flashed back to his past life. And then we found that footage that Matt had shot. Matt shot two movies about his dad, about the recovery process. And we tracked down all the rushes. So we had hundreds of hours of rushes. And it's really nice because he says nothing in his movies are in the film. We just use the rushes because they were more candid and a bit more rough and ready and fitted with the other sort of home video. But when Chris says, I needed to break my back to understand some of these things, and now I'm like, my life makes sense because it's a whole. There's not a before and after. And we felt from that moment we had found the archive, we wanted to get to that moment in a way. We didn't know exactly where it would be, but we felt that, yeah, you said it, just juxtaposition worked really well.
The music is absolutely extraordinary. Huge congratulations, Elon. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous score. It really, really is. I mean, we get little snippets, okay, of the John Williams iconic, huge Superman theme. That can't be an easy ask to create something that's got to, I mean, it holds its own and some against that, which is not an easy thing to do, but you've absolutely smashed it. What was the journey of that, and what were the conversations about what you needed? Because there's so much music in it, from very small, tiny, little tiny motifs to that piece that we just heard there over the end.
I think it's quite unusual for a documentary to have a score on that scale. But I think the heroic story that underpins it allows for that. The John Williams thing, yeah, of course, very daunting. You know, I grew up with Superman and I ran around a playground singing that tune, pretending I could fly. So you know, I've had a whole life of that music, and John Williams is a hero to every composer working in film. So yes, that was very daunting. We talked about whether we could play with that theme, but I think we quickly deserted that idea. But I always knew that, you know, John Williams writes in a very classic Hollywood style that not that many people write in now. And the score is much more contemporary, and I think needed to be much more contemporary. And I think, you know, I didn't want to try to do anything like John Williams, because that would have been impossible. But then there was the problem of, well, how do you go in and out of John Williams? And that is quite daunting. You know, the film begins with a short bit of music by me. It goes straight into John Williams and then straight back into me. So I tackled that by, it's really instrumentation. We used big brass French horns, which is classic Hollywood heroic music, and broad strings, and Superman's full of that. So you can kind of go between the two fairly easily, thankfully.
Sounds so easy.
It wasn't easy, because it's, you know, it's always terrifying. You sit in front of those 88 black and white notes, and that, you know, they're the same ones that Williams sits in front of, and that Wagner sat in front of, and that you know John Lennon sat in front of the same notes as well. So when you think of it like that, and you're like, okay, yeah, pick one, how do you start? Yeah, that's yeah, pretty terrifying.
What were you reacting to, do you think, when you were constructing how those notes would fit together?
I wanted to write something that had the heroism to it, but it needed to be poignant. It's quite hard to do. It's one of those themes that it's neither happy nor sad. When you put it up against something happy, it makes it feel more happy. And when you put it against something sad, it makes it feel more sad. It's like a flavor enhancer. But it's actually very difficult to do. And there isn't a way to explain how you do that. You know, you just keep molding it and playing with it until you find something that is greater than the sum of its parts. It's, yeah, not just notes, it has meaning.
Thank you.
Do you know what you were looking for musically, you know, when you were in the film?
Can we put a pin to this one? I just wanted to say as well, what's amazing working with you, Ilan, is our great editor, Otto Burnham, use a lot of music in when we edit, because our films are so emotional, we need to feel the emotion. So it's always, I think, a challenge, I think, for a composer talking to director. We can't have that. We need to create what we're creating. How do we do that? And I think what's amazing, with Ilan, we did a TV series about the fashion world called Kingdom of Dreams, and we worked together. And I think, again, Otto was one of the editors on that. And I think Ilan is extremely capable to go, if you do fall in love with your temp music, he just managed to, very quickly you forget about it, and very quickly it becomes Ilan's touch. What was your question before?
Just in terms of if you, at what point you kind of knew what the film needed in terms of music, not just in terms of how much, but the kind of the musicality of it. And because there are, like you say, there are so many textures to it. It's not happy. It's not sad. There's all these different elements, the kind of the anxiety that's in there in moments as well. But the joyfulness and the celebration, there's so many.
Can I just, I just think what I've loved about working with you on two projects now, it's a very collaborative process. It's not, there's some jobs that you can get where they say, we just want that. And your job is just to do as you're told. And I try to avoid those kinds of jobs. And this, working with Ian and Peter and Otto, I feel like we spend just a lot of time talking. We'll go and sit in the cutting room and just talk through stuff and watch scenes and talk about what's the emotional narrative. What are we trying to achieve? And so it's truly a creative collaboration. I feel very much like we made the film together.
Totally agree. And we've got story beat, and very quickly we've got voice, I think, decently strong rough cut, 2 hours 40, 2 hours 50 minutes. And you kind of get a sense of where you're going to go, but it's very much the emotion. We very much, like Peter and I and Otto, we have a line, and we're about to go to New York to do a masterclass about it. So I can't believe we're going to do that. It's called emotion over information. I think a lot of trap you can have in documentaries is that, and some great documentaries are like this, but there's a journalistic approach. So it's about making sure you eat all that information. We want people to go on an emotional journey. And if some information are not carried, we apologize if people wanted to know more about the filmography or anything like this. But as long as the emotion, and as long each of our scene merge into another one and gets you from a very dark moment, that we can actually lift you up. And that, you need amazing music to go with that. There's no question. It's like fiction. You can have a great dialogue scene, and silence will make sense if you had potentially something very strong before or after. If it's silence all the time, you don't have those amazing waves of differences.
There were some brilliant information that we learned in the film. And I loved the audience's reaction to that, to the fact that Neil Diamond could have been Superman. That, I mean, singing Superman would have been amazing, wouldn't it?
I would have liked to have seen that.
I would have too. Forever in Blue Jeans. Do you know what I mean? If whatever he wanted to sing, I was there for sure. That was just a great moment as well. And I love that you have those, you know, that's the great thing about the film, I think, is that light and shade and the friendships, the Robin Williams stuff is kind of so beautiful, and the contributors as well. And that was something I wanted to ask about in terms of knowing who to speak to, knowing how many contributors you wanted to have to give their kind of insight into their relationship and their, you know, opinion of him and friendship with him.
Yeah, I mean, after we met the three children, adult people, we knew very much. And after we conducted the out of the four first interviews, the three of them were, and coming out of the interviews, you knew you had the backbone of the film in terms of the emotional aspect of it. And as well, so many such, not flamboyant, but such strong details about their life with their dad and their mom and, you know, both their moms. But what we came to realize is that this film was going to become about family. And then when you talk about family, you talk about extended family, your friends, the friends that stay there, the friends that are non-blood brothers or sisters. And I think all the people we have, we discovered they had that aspect of it. And, you know, yes, Susan Sarandon is a very, very, successful and amazing actress. But first and foremost, she was extremely close to Chris because they created the, we don't talk about it, but they created a coalition called the Creative Coalition. They were the first group of actors who decided, oh my God, we're quite famous. We could use our voice to do something better. And then with Baldwin and some other of the quite famous actors, they just lending their voices to different causes. So that's, in a way, the way we wanted. We never wanted to have too many people, neither. Another thing related to the music is I think some of our characters are like in movies, you want to almost have a little bit of a theme or the emotion you're going to have with some of those characters. And I think Ilan brilliantly did that. It's not as clear as if it was, you know, like in a fiction film, you had the bad guy coming into the room or whatever. But we have a very strong motif when Chris, before the accident, after the accident, and for some of the friends coming in as
yeah.
well.
It is kind of wonderful getting that insight into him from all these different people. And I wondered if for you there was something that really stayed with you that you learned about him from someone else within the film that's kind of just really stayed with you.
Robin Williams is present through Archive, but we don't have an interview with any of his partners or the children. But we became quite close to Marsha Williams, which is his partner of almost 20 years. And she was very present. You know, they call her the fairy godmother. And she gave us a lot of insight. And we sent her the link. She couldn't watch it. We invited to a screening. She walked off after 5-10 minutes. But she finally sat through the film in New York at the premiere, and she sat with Susan through the whole film. And I remember someone telling me at the end, I was like, I was so annoyed. There was those two women kept on crying, but like literally from the first frame. And I turned around and I knew who he was. So I just calmed down. And literally they were in pieces because he was their friends. It was their life and seeing those things. So it's just many little details she told us in confidence, which they're in confidence. But they were very, very close friends and very good people. Yeah. I'd love to make a film about Robin Williams.
Can I answer that question
yeah.
too? Towards the end of us making the film, there was a man called Rob Moriarty who emailed the producers, and he follows me on Instagram. And I'd forgotten this, but he was at university with me, and he was in a wheelchair, and Rob sent in a letter that Christopher had written to him when he was a teenager. He dived into a rock pool. He was paralyzed. And Christopher had written this letter that he says gave him the courage to move forwards, and that has given him, continues to give him the courage to move forwards, you know, even now. And it was this amazing insight. And correct me if I'm wrong, but there's so much correspondence of people writing to Chris, but virtually none of the letters that Chris wrote individually to people. Rob has no idea how Chris could have possibly heard about him and
wow.
his accident. But apparently Chris did a lot of that. And this was amazing to see this real life tangible effect of what Chris did in a sort of very small and personal way.
Yeah,
the foundation just kept track of most of the accidents going on and trying to be there for people. It is quite crazy to know we have an amazing social services in England, in France, in Europe, and we're very lucky. But in the US, if you have an accident which you have paralysis, there's nowhere, no information, no governmental, no nothing, no federal information. The only helpline you can call is the Christopher and Denari Foundation. And it's the only helpline there's ever been. So if you break your back or your children or friend, that's the only people you call. And it's been going on for 30 years. So with the number of accidents, you know, especially in the US, you know, a lot of veterans sometimes come back with things like this. It is constantly the... And I think in Europe, in the rest of the world, we don't realize that actually Reef Foundation is still very present in the psyche of a lot of people in the US, despite he passed away 20 years ago.
Wow. It's amazing the kids are continuing that legacy, isn't it? It's absolutely wonderful. And you celebrate that in the film. Do you know what music he liked?
It's a very good question. Damn, she's good.
I just wondered if it came up, like if there was any footage or anything of him, I don't know, like putting a record on or having the car stereo on or something. Or what did he listen to?
I'm trying to remember
Neil
the music
Diamond,
that they
wasn't
sing
it?
To. With Dena, the dance, you know, the sequence and the dance, and I can't remember the music now.
Whilst you're thinking about that, I can, a slight tangent. I've got a score of the Superman Suite by John Williams, and it has a dedication from John to Christopher, where he says something about, you know, growing up with comic books, but that he wrote this music for his dear friend Christopher, and that the music couldn't have existed without him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Any memories? No, none.
No, I bet Peter would have been there. He would have known every single track. He's the clever one.
I was trying to think of what was around at that time, you know, when he was like at the height of his fame. And we see, you know, when his first marriage breaks up and he's, you know, he's having a bit of a party time, bachelor time.
I mean, Gabe was really plugged in. So they hang out with all the cool people.
It was definitely Studio 54 at some point, wasn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, they know the people. They know everyone.
Everybody. Yeah. That's amazing.
And Matt grew up with a lot of these people, and some of the children of these very successful people are lovely, normal people making great music.
Yeah. What was the adult children's reaction to seeing the film for the first time?
They pulled a trick on us. So they were in New York and we were in London in the Edit Suite. And our financier, which are New York based, organized a screening for them. And Will knows the owner of that finance company. So they have a relationship, a very good friendly relationship. So they sat in a cinema, and basically when we finally got on the Zoom together, they came on and they pretended they didn't realize we were on, and they were arguing with each other and pretending that they had hated moments. So there's the three of us in London, Otto, Peter and I, shitting ourselves from the last hour and a half, because they didn't see anything till a couple of weeks or 3 weeks before we completely locked picture. And they really loved it. They literally, it was a true, like, I thought you were going to make a small movie about our dad, you know, and they thought it would be a lot. They keep on saying that they thought they'll have 30 seconds, 1 minute each. And when Matt, especially when he was like, oh my God, you've helped me so much and telling so many of the emotional beat of the family.
Yeah.
The only thing Will said, and we took the note and it's great, it wasn't a precise note. He said, there was a lot of love and joy in our family. Is there more in the archive to show how much Dena was laughing all the time, singing in the kitchen? There was not a dull moment. Chris had some dark moments, but the house was full of life. Loads of people, loads of lovely people, Laurie, Michael, and many people we didn't interview in the film. They all came to see the screening at different time in the US just to come and say hello and to tell us. And suddenly you see someone 20 years or 30 years older that you've seen in the archive and stuff. So there was a really good group of people around them.
You get a sense of that. You really kind of feel the you know, from those home videos that you feature in the archive, and just the looks on their faces, that kind of candid moments, not even realizing the camera's on, and the kind of smiles that kind of just are beaming from everybody's faces, just a kind of one. And I think that's why it makes it even, you know, kind of sadder when, you know, that point where they've already been through one tragedy, and then Dena as well. It's just like
Matt and Al were destroyed as well. They just had to keep the stuff together for their younger brother.
Yeah.
They actually, we were talking about that. So Will actually ended up being adopted by his neighbors. So his best friend was his neighbor. They were living in in obviously a quite wealthy area, and it was like a dead end with three houses.
Yeah.
I think one house was just a couple without children. The other house had loads of kids, and Will's best friend, Michael Pucci, was there. And when a 21 years old and a 24 years old Matt with Michael were like, okay, what do we do now? Because it happened very quickly, Dena's deterioration and passing. And Michael called the Pucci and said, I think Dena wanted you guys to have it. And that was it. They came, they sold their house. Get me really emotional. We were talking about it. They sold their house so he would never have to walk back through the house. They had three other children, so they outrooted everyone. And every single screening we've been at, the Pucci's are there.
Oh,
and they in Wills asked them to adopt him. So they didn't adopt him. He asked if they could be his parents eventually. So I think he got adopted at like 19 or 20. I didn't have to. You were asking, Ilan, why didn't you use that in the film? It's just, yeah, it's another emotional bit we didn't want to do, but it's nice to be able to tell that story. And I think Will maybe potentially, maybe he would have become too much about Will.
Will, yeah.
Potentially.
Yeah.
But then there's loads of things like that, aren't there? You've got to kind of kill your darlings. There was all the stuff about Chris's activism before the accident that were trying to keep in there for quite a long time. And that was amazing when he went to Chile and, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he went to Chile because Pinochet was actually... Basically, a group of actors reached out to Chris in the US and said, our life's at risk. We are, they were trying to topple the Pinochet regime, and they were fighting for freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And Chris flew to Chile on his own, no bodyguards or anything, and spent 9 days locked in a warehouse with hundreds of activists and artists to prevent... They were surrounded by the army, and anything could have happened. Nothing happened, and actually the Pinochet regime fell through a few months later. But it was this moment where suddenly international media had an eye on that, and you know, he didn't have to do that. He just did it because fellow creative people needed to be safe, so he put his body on the line.
Wow. I mean, I think you've made something that's a beautiful celebration of his life, and it kind of, and loads of things that I didn't know, you know, I didn't really know about the other things. I was little when he was Superman. I didn't know about all the other stuff. I didn't know about his theater work. I didn't know about Juilliard and the fact that he was roommates with Robin Williams. And it's just lovely that you're kind of retelling his life in all its glory. You know, a really wonderful collection of things. You've made a very, very special and emotional film. Huge congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you for chatting to us tonight. Thank you for being here, ladies and gentlemen. Round of applause, please, for Ilan and Ian. From The Score to Superman, the Christopher Reeve story, that's 1973 by Ilan Eshkari, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with Ilan and one of the directors, Ian Bonnot. Now, Ian mentioned Rising Phoenix there, the film that he made with Peter about Paralympian athletes. So we thought we'd share a clip of the pair talking about it back in episode 215.
For me, from my advertising and short form background, the Superhuman campaign in 2012 was a massive campaign, what they had Channel 4 had done. So visually, I think I had never felt, after that commercial in 2012, I had never looked at anyone with a disability the same way. And it suddenly was like, you know, it's those emotions that you feel watching somebody else's work and how it changed your own perspective, where Peter and I received that project and we said, like, we need to top that up. They're not superhumans. They're above that. And I think there's this idea that even in McQueen, we always like to borrow from drama or scripted and genre film. You know, there's we find it a bit sad that many times documentary, they just categorize the documentary. And a lot of people, I'm talking in the broader public, is like, ooh, documentary, it's either TV things or it's a highbrow or it's intellectual. But what we did with McQueen, we like things to be visual, entertaining, shocking, a bit punk and all the rest of it. So it was the same attitude we took with that. And I think the idea of making it a superhero movie and them to be like the Marvel Avengers came straight away. So we kind of devise it like this to start with as a concept. And that, you know, that doesn't tell you, answer your question about exactly how we told the story. But what was incredible is our first interview with the first athlete, which was Jean-Baptiste Alès, the French Paralympian long jumper, within 20 minutes, half an hour. He doesn't speak much English, a bit like me. So we were talking in French about it. Peter is fluent in French, so we could talk. And suddenly he started talking about them being the Avengers and getting, coming together and saving the world. And me and Peter, we were like, and that was, you know, after talking about, you know, he had witnessed his mom being almost decapitated in front of him, him being chopped in pieces. You know, I don't want to tell too much if people haven't seen the film. So his own personal story was crazy. So he was like amazing. And we had chosen him because he had this amazing, you know, immigration, adoption, traveling the world to be able to be where he is anyway. Mm-hmm. But then him talking about the Avenger Assemble was just like, oh my God. So that's the time, the framework conceptual.
And what we asked him, the question was, what does it feel like when you all get together at the Paralympics? And he kind of like said, well, you know what, you know, the last Avengers movie, kind of thinking, okay. And I literally had goosebumps when he was, you know, because I was behind the monitor watching, and I kind of thought, okay, there's the, you know, we weren't idiots to have had that direction.
Ian and Peter on their wonderful film, Rising Phoenix.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
My huge thanks to Ian and Elon for taking the time to talk to me, and of course to the good folk at Everyman for looking after us so well. Superman the Christopher Reeve Story is available to watch now on Apple TV and other streaming services, and we have another Soundtrack in Everyman Film Club coming up on Tuesday the 3rd of December. We are going to be holding a special screening of Will and Harper, followed by an In Conversation with Will and Harper after the film. Can't wait, can't believe it. So make sure you head to our socials to get all the details on how you can be part of the audience for that one. Also head to edithbowman.com to hear that chat that I mentioned earlier with Ian and Peter in full. And you'll find Elon there too if you use the super effective search function. Find all of our episodes there. Please follow us on your socials. We're at Soundtracking UK to keep up with everything that's going on the podcast. And do subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is Soundtracking Extra. Next up, I'm utterly thrilled to be in the company of John M. Chu, the director, and Stephen Schwartz, who is the composer and the original creator of Wicked the Musical. The Broadway stage show, the West End stage show, and John is the director of the film, which is out in cinemas as of the 22nd of November. That is going to be our next episode of Soundtracking, and I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.